Long Talk Radio.
Welcome to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. This is Alejandro Rojas, your host for the evening, and I will be taking you on a wonderful trip through the beautiful plains of Roswell, where a UFO crashed and there were aliens and they freaked people out and the government hid them away and threatened people and lied to people. And oh my gosh, it's this crazy drama that is going to unfold this evening right before your very ears. We have on, as part of a Roswell special, because Roswell happened in early July, July 3rd is when they think the actual craft crashed. Which is coming up here in just a few days. I know it's almost July already. My birthday's in July. That means I'm going to be another year old. We have one of the top experts, Tom Carey, on the show tonight. He has been researching Roswell for a long time and is now part of the dynamic duo with Don Schmidt. These are the top guys researching Roswell now. And he's written the last book, Witness to Roswell, with Don. And they've been doing a lot of research, so we're going to talk to him about that research. Of course, what he thinks of Annie Jacobson's Area 51 book, which recently alleged that Roswell was due to, you know, the Russians dealing with the Nazis and all kinds of craziness. So we'll talk about that and many other things. So this is going to be a lot of fun. And Antonio and I are going to see Don and Tom and Stan Friedman, the three top UFO researchers. I think another one, Kevin Randall's going to be there too. So the top four, those are really the top four. In Roswell, because we're going to be at the Roswell Museum, Antonio and I selling magazines and open mind stuff. So come and see us. Come and see Tom and Don and Stanton and everybody. Sit on Stanton's lap. He kind of looks like Santa Claus, and you can make your Santa Claus wish there. And it'll be your Roswell wish. He's your Roswell Santa Claus. And it'll be a lot of fun. He loves that. He loves the attention. And as long as you buy a book, I'm sure he'll let you sit on his lap and he'll sign it for you while you're there. So it's going to be a lot of fun this weekend, and it's going to be a lot of fun tonight talking to Tom. So, like I said, Roswell this weekend, there's still rooms available, actually. I was just reading in the news. We posted some news last week about Roswell, and they said that there are rooms available if you want to get a room to go check out the festivities there. So, of course, that's over the July 4th weekend from the 1st to the 4th. And I want to advise you, we're not going to have a show on the 4th because Antonio and I will be coming back from Roswell, and all of you will be out partying and blowing stuff up because that's what we do. We light firecrackers and blow stuff up for some reason. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's to threaten the British that you better not come back. And because we'll blow you up. Everybody's got explosives in America and weapons, and we will blow you up. And that's probably why we blow stuff up, to keep them from coming back. We should do that in front of the British embassy then. Be like, you know, come on, you little wussies. We don't care if you bring James Bond. We'll blow him up too. Put an M80 down his pants. So that's my theory as to why we blow stuff up on Independence Day. MUFON is also coming up, the MUFON Symposium. Of course, we've had some of their speakers as guests recently, and that's going to be July 29th through the 31st. Also, we do have a new online video up with some news and information about our new magazine, Hollywood and UFOs. How exciting does that sound? Well, if that sounds exciting, you're going to be even more excited when you see the magazine because it's really cool. And we've got a YouTube you can watch on that. Although, we've got another YouTube video that our news correspondent Jason McClellan put up that's skyrocketed. It almost has 100,000 views so far, and you've probably seen that because we have about 500,000 listeners probably listening right now. Maybe even 3 million, so not all of them have watched yet because only 100,000 have watched. So go watch that video. I may be exaggerating our numbers a little bit. But that person that I'm talking about, the news correspondent, Jason McClellan, is actually in the studio tonight because we put UFO news up every day, and Jason shares that UFO news with us. Jason, how are you, buddy?
Wonderful as usual, Alejandro.
Enjoying the stardom?
The stardom.
From your video doing so well?
There is no stardom, and I enjoy that.
Oh, that's good, too.
Excellent. Well, thank you for having me, Alejandro. It's good to be here. And greetings, everyone. This is your Open Minds News Brief for Monday, June 27th, 2011. There's a new film titled Montauk Chronicles, and it explores the legends of mind control, time travel, and other experiments in the presence of extraterrestrials that supposedly took place at Camp Hero, a now-decommissioned Air Force base in Montauk, New York. Tales of experiments being conducted on nearly 100,000 people over the course of 10 years, kidnappings, murder, torture, time travel, mind control, and extraterrestrial contact are all said to have occurred at Camp Hero. And this movie has a release date of July 7th of this year. And Lee Spiegel from AOL sat down with the film's creator recently and spoke to him about the process of making this film and his research and actually filming some of it at Camp Hero. But Alejandro, what is your take on all of this Montauk story stuff?
Well, I think the Montauk base, it does look interesting, more interesting than I thought. It used to look like maybe it was just this tower. But it looks like it was mostly underground in this park. But it's a park where, like, people go. I mean, it's a park where people can go. You can't go into these old bunkers or whatever. But, yeah, the Montauk whole story is really zany, crazy stuff with stargates and people going to Mars and time traveling. And there was even, and I can't remember the details, about stealing Jesus' spear in order to save his life or something like that. They were doing all these crazy battles, aliens coming through the stargates and wreaking havoc, and I guess they just like threw them through, get out of here, jerk, and threw them back. Really, really crazy, wild stuff. So maybe there was, I think, you know, Spiegel kind of alludes to in his story, I think, that maybe there were some brainwashing type of experimentation going on there. Who knows? But it's a closed base now, and I really, the zanier stuff, I'm not sure if I buy, honestly.
I think the coolest thing for me about that story and the video that Spiegel did with the film's creator was seeing the photos of the actual base,
yeah,
and seeing those, you know, manhole covers for the, yeah, underground, whatever, and things, parts of the base completely walled off with these brick walls and things, just completely closing off entrances.
I went to Google, and I called Antonio over, look, and if you Google, you can Google in on some of that stuff, and you can Google in on the big antenna array and stuff. It's kind of neat.
It's cool. Interesting. Well, it sounds like an interesting movie, at least. So, but it sounds like it's mostly an independent film. And
now it looks like a documentary, right?
It does look like a documentary.
Yeah. So it might be fun. It'll be interesting, that's for sure.
Right. Well, we talked about it last week, and we had a conversation about how I'd probably be speaking about it again this week, and I'm not letting you down, Alejandro. I'm talking about SETI, of course.
Ah, those sons again.
The SETI, or Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Institute is seeking donations from the public to resume operations at the Allen Telescope Array in Hat Creek, California. This move comes just 2 months after SETI announced the indefinite suspension of operations at the Allen Telescope Array due to budgetary cutbacks. SETI is calling their fundraising efforts SETI Stars. And as the Huffington Post reports, the SETI Stars program was set up and presented to the SETI Institute by a number of Silicon Valley technologists who wanted to help SETI raise money by creating something that would take advantage of the evolving world of social networking. Tom Pearson, SETI's CEO, told AOL that the Institute's goal is to raise $200,000 from the public and combine that amount with funds that have already been raised. This level of public support would enable SETI to resume operations, which includes utilizing their array of radio telescopes to listen for signals from extraterrestrials. According to Pearson, the Allen Telescope Array costs, brace yourself for this, okay? It costs $2.5 million a year to operate.
Whoa.
And you and I had this conversation last week, Alejandro. there are so many things, so many other efforts that could be nicely benefited by $2.5 million a year.
Yep. With $2.5 million, I could capture a flying saucer. Well, I don't know. But I might, at least I could give it a good go.
Certainly, it seems there are other efforts out there other than listening for something that might not be there. These weird radio waves. But there are many other private companies right now working on their spacecraft to go into space and explore.
Yep.
And it seems the money would be better spent there. That's my opinion.
I agree with you. Yeah, totally. I mean, if they wanted to send us a message, they could. I don't think we need to be doing these. Maybe having one guy listening or paying attention who's in charge of that. But, I mean, yeah, to spend all this money, like we're going to catch them off guard. Oh, and we're going to catch one of their signals that was unintended.
And as we pointed out before, SETI's not the only organization doing this. There are organizations around the world doing this with their radio telescopes.
Yeah.
So,
$2.5 million.
I mean, I like what they're doing, but, you know, for that price tag, I think the money's better spent elsewhere.
We could have a network of people across the country with infrared cameras and gear watching the skies every night.
Yeah. We much better use of time and resources to have that many people watching for UFOs.
And then we can pay scientists to analyze this stuff.
Right.
And, you know, in a real sense and say, hey, you know, get better things than the skeptics telling us they're birds.
Right. But we don't have $2.5 million a year.
Mm-mm.
It's not up to us, so we'll let them do what they do.
Yeah.
Well, in other news, Academy Award-winning actor Morgan Freeman currently hosts a show called Through the Wormhole on Discovery Network's Science Channel. Freeman challenges viewers to ponder the bold questions surrounding life and existence, according to The Hollywood Reporter. A Huffington Post article recently stated, for Freeman, exploring the question of space and existence has been a longtime love, born of his interest in science fiction. It was that fiction that opened his eyes to the possibilities of reality. Freeman ponders extraterrestrial life on the show. We've seen different manifestations of others' imaginations of aliens. Aliens could look like anything. It depends a lot on their environment. We portray them as having two arms, two legs, a head, two eyes, a nose, two ears, and that's not necessarily true. They could look more lizardly, and they could look like anything, Freeman muses. There's just no way of knowing. Through the Wormhole is in its second season on Science. The show explored the topic of extraterrestrial life last season and continues to do so this season. I just found out about this show, and I've got to say, it looks pretty fascinating.
Yeah, that's cool. I love Morgan Freeman. Who doesn't love Morgan Freeman? I mean, he's one of the coolest guys, does good work, is on good stuff. That is one thing that I liked about the War of the Worlds movie was his narration was great when he did the Orson Welles pieces at the beginning and the end. That's about all I liked of the newer.
He's one of my favorite narrators. Who doesn't love his voice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's great. He's really great. So that is really exciting.
Well, it's sort of an interesting side note. I mean, here's an actor who, on more than one occasion, has portrayed God.
Right, that's true.
And now he's hosting a show that's taking a look at life.
He's been the president at least once, too, right?
I think so.
In that asteroid movie, he was president.
Right.
Yeah.
But which asteroid movie?
The one without...
The one with Bruce Willis?
No, the other one.
The other one.
Deep Impact.
Deep Impact, there you go.
I like that one better.
Yeah. Well, scientists believe that one of Saturn's moons might have a salty ocean beneath its icy shell. A team of scientists used the Cassini Space Probe's Cosmic Dust Analyzer. Sounds cool. Their probe has a cosmic dust analyzer on it. Sounds like Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
They use this to examine plumes of water spouting from geysers on Saturn's icy moon Enceladus. Analysts show that the particles closer to the moon's surface have a high salt concentration. Previous studies found low amounts of salt in particles that make up Saturn's rings, but by sampling the geysers directly, research was able to determine that more than 99% of the ice around the geyser is salt-rich, according to Space.com. This new study suggests that the reservoirs that feed the moon's geysers connect to a larger ocean approximately 50 miles underground. Frank Postberg of the University of Heidelberg, who led the study, pointed out to Space.com that an underground ocean on Enceladus could be a target for locating extraterrestrial life. Space.com summarized Postberg's explanation. Unlike other unseen oceans in the solar system, the water on Enceladus is fairly easy to reach. Jupiter's moon Europa, for instance, could have an ocean under a layer of ice, but retrieving it would require significant effort. By contrast, the geysers on Enceladus pull material and potentially life, should it exist there, from its oceans and shoot it into space. The research was published in the June 22nd online edition of the journal Nature.
Yeah, that's really exciting. I mean, a second planet with an underwater ocean. That is just, I love the thought of that because your imagination runs wild of the type of creatures that could be in some sort of extraterrestrial ocean.
Right.
And what if life evolved there and became intelligent? I mean, an underwater civilization. How cool is that?
And just in the past couple of months, we've also talked about new studies that add to the evidence to support that there is an ocean, underground ocean on Titan as well, mm-hmm. another one of Saturn's moons.
Yeah, that's exciting. What if there's an advanced civilization underwater there? They came here and they have a secret base under the water. Maybe though it's supposed base by Puerto Rico, that's these guys.
It's certainly a possibility there, Alejandro.
Amazing.
But it's discoveries like this that, you know, force us to rethink our search for extraterrestrial life, because we've talked about this before. It seems like there's a closed-minded approach where they're just looking for another Earth.
Yeah.
It's got to be exactly like Earth, or else there can't be life.
And it's these kind of things, you have these scientists with these closed minds, and it's these kind of things that have to pry those minds open, because out of the box is just a totally foreign thing to these guys.
Right.
They can't think out of the box. So you need these wild things that they discover to kind of open up their perception.
Well, and then with this moon, with the salt ocean, you know, that helps too, because that's more familiar to us. The salt ocean, that's like our ocean, you know, as opposed to other methane oceans or whatever some of these other planets might have.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's more familiar to us, something more Earth-like, then people pay attention to it and get really excited about it.
Yeah.
But I'm with you there. I think there's underwater stuff there and underwater stuff here.
Dolphin people.
All underwater. Well, this was pretty big news today. It continues to be big news, and it's kind of mysterious as to why that is. But videos have surfaced online that reportedly show multiple UFOs above London on the afternoon of Friday, June 24th. That's this past Friday. The UFOs in the videos are lights in the daytime sky that don't have the appearance of the traditional metal aircraft. These orbs are shown hovering in the sky, then zipping behind clouds, seemingly playing hide-and-seek with the camera. Two videos of these orb UFOs were uploaded to the internet by the same person. He uploaded his first video on June 16th, and the description accompanying that video explains that he had been seeing these odd lights over central London randomly for the past week, and he finally managed to get them on camera on the evening of Wednesday, June 15th. According to The Telegraph, this video is believed to have been shot from inside the offices of a visual effects company called The Mill, a company that creates special effects for the film industry. That's a little detail that certainly raises doubts regarding the authenticity of the alleged UFOs. Well, the second video uploaded is creating an international buzz right now, and the description provided on that video states, "Right, took over a week to get it, but finally managed to get these critters on camera on a clear day, and even get a close-up. It seems to be attracting quite a crowd now when they appear. Can anyone explain what on earth these lights are, please?" A response to this video was posted to YouTube by the user HoaxKiller1 to point out a flaw in the video. As one of the UFOs is passing behind a building, it's temporarily visible in front of the building instead of behind the building, which led HoaxKiller1 to conclude that this object is clearly fake and was made using computer-generated graphics. Another issue with the UFO in the video is that at times they appear to match the movements of the shaky camera, something that indicates less than perfect motion tracking by the video's creator. This flaw was also noticed by HoaxKiller1, who stated in the description of his video, "They didn't match move the UFO with enough precision to match the camera shake, so you can see it is bouncing around." There are other videos from June 24th that appear to show the same orbs in the sky above London. But the veracity of these videos is also unclear. It's under scrutiny because the problems with the initial video. The UFOs in the videos, all of the videos, remain unidentified. And while they're unconfirmed, while the theory is unconfirmed, the general consensus is it's all bogus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's getting so much play because it was over the BBC building. And in the video, it looks like, you know, they're coming across people who are already looking.
Right.
Which could be their coworkers. Mm-hmm. Let's all go outside and stage this thing. And I think that's why it's so exciting, because what I had noticed was two things. Not only the shake, because the object should, you know, be totally aligned with, like, the clouds in its movement. If the clouds wiggle, it should wiggle mm-hmm. the same. And, right, it was dirt. At least one moment where their shaking wasn't aligned correctly. The other is the soft, in a lot of the fakes, these objects, especially the smaller, further away, will have like a soft halo around them, whereas real objects are hard, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Look at a lot of the UFO videos, even some that turn out to be birds or otherwise, and I've seen several of, I've even seen myself what appear to be orbs or something in the day sky, a little thing flying by, and they're really hard edges, not kind of this light edges like these things had. So that's what threw me, but then the wall, where the object is seen on this side of the wall when it's supposed to be going behind the building. That is something that Bruce McAbee has caught other people with fakes with that very thing before. So, yeah, it looks like it's a big hoaxer on this one.
Right, and I think a lot of people were hopeful with this one, that this could be something credible, because like with the Jerusalem UFO, you've got different locations here that supposedly caught the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Multiple cameras, multiple locations. But lots of red flags with this one. So,
yep.
So, obviously, we don't know for sure, but it looks like hoax.
Yeah.
Too bad.
Looking bad.
Yep. Well, since I've just talked about London, I'll continue talking about London. Good old
Great.
London. Especially since you sort of threatened the British blowing stuff up, Alejandro.
Well, we gained our independence. That's what we're celebrating, and we're blowing stuff up. That's just my guess as to why we blow stuff up.
Americans love to blow stuff up.
Yeah, just for the heck of
it. Well, scientists and other experts will be gathering in London to discuss the search for extraterrestrial life. As First Perspective reported this weekend, this will be a two-day meeting of Britain's Royal Society to consider the progress made and the challenges posed in the hunt for alien beings. And as he has done before, Arizona State University astrophysicist Paul Davies will be on hand to discuss how aliens could be right under our noses, or even in our noses. Davies, of course, speaks about microbial life that could have arrived here from another planet. The old panspermia theory.
Yeah. Yeah, which is always interesting. So, yeah, that's really cool.
That's really cool. The Royal Society has done this many times before. It's
mm-hmm.
something they're very interested in. And these are
yep.
the top of the top scientists.
Mm-hmm. Doing cool stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, they'll figure something out.
Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah.
All right, Alejandro, that is it for the news. Remember to check out these stories and more at openminds.tv, your source for UFO-related news. I'm Jason McClellan, your Open Minds news correspondent, and you've been briefed. Back to you, Alejandro.
All right. Thank you, Jason. And actually, I'm going to write about this in a couple of days about Moscow. There's another meeting going on, a SETI type of meeting in Moscow this week. And they are much more open-minded in Russia than they are even our Western world friends out there in the UK. When they are friends, hey, I love the UK. I'm not threatening to blow them up. I just think that maybe that's the thing we're doing for the Independence Day. But this is really exciting, all this talk about science and astrobiology and trying to discover ways to talk about UFOs and or extraterrestrial intelligence. In fact, there was a story just today that came out that one of these Russian scientists is predicting that definitely in the next 20 years, we will find extraterrestrial life. I think he's talking about probably some basic indications of life. And these days, with all of these astronomical discoveries, I think people are feeling that that could be a conservative estimate. It may be a lot sooner than that. So these are exciting times, people. As far as some of the other stories that we have going on the website, we have, I talked earlier about Tom Carey, who's going to be on our show in a little bit, and we've had Don Schmidt on the show not too long ago, and their book Witness to Roswell, they had made some pretty interesting discoveries, and they got these discoveries from witnesses, eyewitnesses, mostly, but not completely, firsthand witnesses. One of those being about people seeing a trailer carrying what seemed to be a craft through the town in Roswell. Michael wrote a story on that with some really neat images from a gentleman named John McNeil, who has kind of illustrated what that might have looked like. And these are really cool images. And we just posted another one today, and actually I'll be talking to Tom about this. And that is The Secret of Hangar P3. So it was really, P3 was the name of the hangar where they took the stuff, the Roswell vehicle and the aliens. And John McNeil has done another cool graphic to show what that might have looked like. But we talk about, you know, some of the witnesses who had seen or heard about some of the military guys who were on the actual base, who saw the planes coming and going, how many planes were coming and going, why so many planes were coming and going. So Michael Schratt wrote about that as well. So some really cool stories that we have on Roswell now that we are gearing up for the anniversary, which is coming up in just a few days. What is that? Monday, Tuesday? That's like Sunday. The crash was on the 3rd. Yeah, I think the 3rd is Sunday. I can't believe it's July already. So those are some of the stories that you can see on the website. Really, some of the stories that have been getting a lot of press are the ones that Antonio wrote on the Argentina Air Force and their UFO commission, because that's really exciting that they have a real UFO commission. They're working with civilian UFO ufologists. And then also Jason's UFO over Mexico video that I talked about earlier, that's on our YouTube. Or you can, of course, come and see it on our website, openminds.tv. But without further ado, let's go ahead and bring on Tom Carey and talk some Roswell. All right. I am very happy to have on the phone Tom Carey. Tom, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Alejandro. Have a great day. Sun's out here, and I hope it's sunny where you're at.
Oh, yeah. We're in Arizona, so we're in the desert, and it's sunny and very hot. 115 today, I think.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's dry, right? It's dry heat.
It is dry. It is very different. In fact, and plus the low elevation, like in Colorado where I'm from, you know, you would die. And I used to think people must die in Arizona, but it's different. You can tolerate a higher heat out here.
Absolutely.
So, and it's, we're going to be talking about the desert, the New Mexico desert. I guess to start off, I wanted to know how you first got interested in the Roswell case.
Well, I never heard of the Roswell case, to be honest with you, until 1980.
Mm-hmm.
I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto, and I was in a local UFO group there, and someone mentioned that a book was coming out on the Roswell incident. And I had lived in California in Sacramento for 10 years, and just east of Sacramento was a town called Roseville. So I thought, oh, they mean Roseville, not Roswell. And they said, no, Roswell, New Mexico. I never heard of it. So in 1980, when the book came out, of course, I bought it, and I was just transfixed by this story that, as opposed to lights in the sky and people, you know, describing lights flitting about. Here was a craft that apparently, allegedly, had crashed with wreckage and bodies. And it had been covered up for decades. And this had just everything that piqued my interest. So that was my original introduction to the Roswell case, was the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident.
Mm-hmm. And were you already interested in UFOs then?
Yes, I was, Alejandro. I was interested as a teenager. I read the Donald Kehoe books, who to this day remains my favorite author,
mm-hmm.
about UFOs. Kehoe wrote half a dozen or so books about flying saucers, as they were known then. And that the interest really never died. Sort of suppressed it for a while I was in graduate school, but I was still interested in UFOs and read books even when I was in graduate school, and so it never really died. And when I came back to Philadelphia in the late 70s, on into the mid-80s, I wanted to actually do something other than just read the books. I wanted to become involved. And by that time, there were additional articles coming out about the Roswell case by Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, who were writing in the periodical The International Reporter for the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies. So that's how I became reacquainted with UFOs, and especially the Roswell incident was in that manner.
And so eventually, of course, you became partnered up with Don, and now you continue that partnership looking into it. How did that happen?
Yes. Well, as you know, 1997 was the 50th anniversary year of the Roswell incident, 1947 to 1997. And all of the hoopla that surrounded the case sort of came to a crescendo with national media coverage. Most of the books ever written about Roswell were written in 1997. And by that time, I had been working with Don Schmidt and Kevin Randall in their investigation of the Roswell incident. I joined the team by investigating one aspect of the case for them. And by 97, the case was on the cover of Time magazine. It was on all the networks, et cetera, et cetera. So after the 97 hoopla, most of the researchers left the field. They had written their books, and it was never going to get any more popular than it was in 97.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to continue a proactive, and I emphasize the word proactive, investigation of the Roswell incident. And by proactive, I mean not just sitting around waiting for people to call me or send me emails,
right,
but to actually go out there and start shaking the tree for witnesses and information. And at that point, I met Don Schmidt in Chicago during a QFOS, or for the Center for UFO Studies, meeting. And we decided to take a trip to Roswell together in May of 1998 to just see what if there was anything left to investigate. And that's been, 13 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and we're still a team. And there's been plenty to learn since then. It wasn't a dead case. There were still nuggets to find, and we're still working on it.
So in that trip in 1989, you all discovered there was more to research. What did you discover on that trip?
Well, this would be 1998.
Oh, 98, sorry.
The first thing we discovered was there was a old-time witness still alive named Frank Joyce, and I remember it distinctly. We Joyce lived in Albuquerque. He had been just retired as a newsman, a features editor, a features reporter for KOB TV in Albuquerque. And over the years, Joyce had told his story about being a reporter on the radio station KGFL in Roswell in 1947, when Mac Brazel, the sheep rancher, he's the one that first found the wreckage on his ranch, the strange wreckage. And he came in, and Brazel came into town and went to the sheriff's office and told his story to Sheriff George Wilcox. And just at that point, Wilcox received a phone call from Frank Joyce, who at that point was spinning records and talking about cattle feed and good bargains in farming equipment and stuff like that on the radio station. And he asked Wilcox, the sheriff, hey, George, do you have any good stories I can use on the air? You know, some human interest, anything happen, let me know. I'll put it on the air. And he says, well, by the way, I have a fellow standing here right next to me by the name of Mac Brazel. He runs a sheep ranch out in near Corona, and he's found all of this strange wreckage on his ranch. And here, let me put him on the phone. And so Joyce interviewed Brazel over the phone, and he told Joyce some things that Joyce never revealed to anyone until that day in May of 1998 that Don Schmidt and I visited with him. He said, I'm going to tell you some things I've alluded to over the years but never really told anybody until now. I'm going to tell you, so once I get started, don't stop me, because I just might not start up again.
Mm-hmm.
So we let him talk, and he revealed the so-called rest of the story that he knew about Brazel. Most notably, that Brazel had found bodies in addition to the strange wreckage. All these years, Joyce had talked about the strange wreckage, but never mentioned the bodies that Brazel had found. And he said, I always said there was more to my story, but that I didn't want to reveal it until that day in May of 1998, when fortuitously Don Schmidt and I showed up, and he felt like revealing it. And that was the first inkling to us that there is more to learn about the Roswell story.
Mm-hmm.
And right off the bat, we got that information.
Right, and then you continued. I mean, you found this witness, and you continued to find more witnesses.
Yes.
And you continue to find them to this day.
Absolutely. We've got some new ones the last week.
Wow.
We're still working on them, but it's not that they come forward and say, oh, boy, here I am, I want to be interviewed. It's just not that way at all.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, 99 times out of 100, the stories are bogus and the witnesses are bogus. The witnesses that really are genuine are the ones that we have to really search for and dig out, because they don't come forward. You have to actually find them. It's like I said, shake the tree. If you're not shaking the tree, you're not going to find any, because they're not going to fall into your lap.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very detailed labor of what do they call it? Labor intensive. It's labor intensive. It's you just don't sit back and they come rolling in.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go after them. And a lot of people find that daunting. And I know myself, when it's a day where I'm going to make phone calls to try to locate and interview witnesses, I have to psych myself up, because it is very daunting to call somebody up.
Yeah.
Out of the blue, cold turkey. They don't know me. And the first 10 seconds are critical to identify yourself and the reason you're calling, and hope that they don't hang up on you. So that's, and I'm still doing that. So
And the procedure you guys go through, so essentially, for instance, you'll find out who the officers or who the people at the base were, and then start tracking those people.
Absolutely. Lots of times we'll get leads. Lots of times people will give us leads, but they won't give us names. So how can we check something if we don't have names? So what we do, short of someone telling us, go interview former Airman John Smith, what we do is we have a copy of the Roswell Base Yearbook from 1947 with 3,000 pictures and names to go with them in the yearbook.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do is I'll pick names not like John Smith or Sam Jones or George Brown. You know, you have to pick a name that's idiosyncratic, that's unique enough that you have a stand a chance of finding the name in the online directory. And that's how we do it. And I've been very successful at that. If you don't, if the person is still not is no longer alive, and in most cases they are no longer alive, you'll get a family member. Because oftentimes they'll still list the name under the deceased husband. If it's a wife, they'll still list it under the husband's name, even though he's deceased.
Have you ran across a situation where you get a hold of one of these guys and they're relieved to hear from you? They're like, I've been wanting to talk to somebody about this.
Once. In all of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of phone calls that I've made, it's happened once. And that was Earl Fulford. Oh, I'd say about 6 years ago. He was just a name and a face in the yearbook. Former sergeant. In the 509th Bomb Group, worked in the air engineering squadron that refurbished the B-29 engines. And I called him. He just died recently. His wife is still alive. They live in Plano, Florida. And I called the number, not knowing if he was still alive or, you know. And his wife answered, and she says, oh, I'm so glad you called. Yes, my husband is right here. He is ready to talk. He wants to talk to somebody. I couldn't believe it.
That must have been exciting.
Yes. It was so out of the ordinary. I thought I was dreaming. Thought I was dreaming. And he turned out to be a terrific witness. He knew a lot. He told us everything that he knew, and as a matter of fact, he was featured in the UFO Hunters show when we were in Roswell 2 years ago. He took us out to the hangar where he worked, and we took him out to the Brazel Ranch where all the wreckage came down, and unfortunately, he died within 2 weeks of returning home. So, he was just a great guy, and I still correspond with his wife. And that was the one case where someone actually was happy to have me call him. Usually it's the other way around.
And with him, what was some of the stuff he revealed to you immediately?
Well, he was one. First of all, he was one of the airmen. He was a sergeant, but we'll call him airman, that was put on a truck and driven out to the debris field site to actually pick up the wreckage. And he described to us how many airmen were with him at the time, what they did, and he described the wreckage that he actually personally handled. And his description was typical of the description for this so-called memory metal, the metal that you can wad up in your hand, you can crinkle it up into a ball and just let it go, and it'll flatten right out before it hits the ground or a table or something like that. You can't cut it, scratch it, burn it, or deform it or deface it in any manner. And he described how he had trouble putting these pieces of memory metal in his burlap sack. They were each airman was given a burlap sack to put anything that wasn't natural. Those were the instructions. Put anything that's not natural into this burlap sack, and then they would on their way out, they would hand over the sacks, and they would all be dumped into a wheelbarrow. So he described how he would pick up a piece of this memory metal and crinkle it up like a piece of paper that you're just wadding up to toss in the trash can. He would toss it in there, but it would flatten right out immediately, and it would get stuck. He would miss the bag. It would just float around, and he says, "What is this?" So he finally got the knack of it. He kept his hand wrapped around the piece of metal, memory metal, and he would put his hand way down in the burlap bag before he released it, so it would stay in the bag. And that was sort of interesting, because he's the only one that really describes something utilitarian as putting a piece of it in a bag,
mm-hmm.
and the way he had to do it. So, when their shift was over, they would they lined up and they handed their bags to the central depository, and then they were taken back to the base. The other interesting story he told, there were two other stories that Earl Fulford told us. The one was that he got off his shift. This would be on July the 8th, 1947, actually a day or two before they drove him out to the crash site. He had a friend in his squadron who was a truck driver, and they were eating breakfast at the chow hall about 6 a.m. And they noticed his friend, Sergeant George Houck, having breakfast by himself. And they could see out in the parking lot this long, low-boy tractor trailer. And so he goes over and he says, what you doing here, George? And he says, "Oh, I'm going up north. This would be north of town. And, "Oh, that's interesting. Do you know why?" He says, "No, they just told me to get a low boy and head north of town after you have breakfast." Well, that was sort of the end of the, great, have a great day, So Fulford's getting off his shift around 4 p.m. in the afternoon. And he's heading for his car. He had a car, and he and another fellow were heading for their car, heading for the parking. Nope, strike that. They were heading for the NCO club. That's where they were heading. They were heading for the NCO club across the base, and they were walking across the parking lot. They saw this lowboy coming in through the main gate and heading for them. And it was actually heading for the big hangar where all of the wreckage was being deposited. And he says, that's George Houck. And he could see there was a tarpaulin on the back and something under the tarpaulin. So he goes out into the middle of the road there, and we went to that spot when Earl was brought to Roswell 2 years ago. I said, "George, where did this happen?" He says, "Right, okay, let me take you to it." So we stood right there where he flagged down this big tractor trailer with the low boy. And so the tractor stops, and it's George Houck in there. And so Earl says, "Where you been, George?" He says, "Well, I've been up north." And he says, "Well, what do you got there under the tarp?" And he says, "I can't tell you." He says, "Oh, sure you can." So Earl and his friend, they head back to the back of the lowboy, and they're about to lift up the tarp to see what's under there, and Houck jumps out of the truck and he says, get away from there, you can't look. And he says, "Why not?" He says, "I don't know, they just told me not to let anyone look under the tarp." Well, so with that, he tells Fulford and his friend to go, you know, get out of there, and which they do. They continue to cross to the NCO club, and Hauk drives the low boy right into the big hangar where all of the wreckage is being deposited. Well, we know from witnesses in Roswell who saw the trailer go right through the center of town with this tarp that there was wreckage underneath. They could see parts of it sticking out, and in at least one occasion the tarp flapped back and someone could see an egg-shaped, silvery egg-shaped craft underneath the tarp, parts of it anyway. So we know that's what it was. We know he came from the so-called impact site, which was different from the Brazel site. And the impact site is where the part of the ship that didn't disintegrate when it exploded, the rest of it went another 30 miles and came to rest just north of Roswell. And that's what Hauk was hauling back to the base.
So, have you ever been able to get a hold of him?
Yes. He's still alive. I've talked to him several times.
Uh-huh.
And he tried to claim he didn't know Earl Fulford, and they were best friends. And I can tell you, having been in the Air Force myself in the 60s, you never forget who your best friends were.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to claim he never heard of Earl Fulford, and then I reminded him of the story, and he says, oh yes, I know who you're talking about. He wouldn't divulge what it was. In fact, he denied driving the truck. Now, Earl Fulford has never lied to me. Everything he said has checked out. And Hauk first denied that he drove the truck. And my most recent call to him, which was maybe 6 months ago, he denied ever hearing about the Roswell incident or being aware of anything on the base that took place of this nature, which is just absolute nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's his fallback position. I don't know what you're talking about. I never heard of Roswell. I wasn't aware of anything that took place on the base. And so he's what we call a reluctant witness.
Yeah. When you're calling these witnesses, what percentage, I mean, are most of them reluctant, or what is kind of the percentage?
They're very tight-lipped.
Uh-huh.
Because you're now 64 years removed from the event.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're just finding them now and they've not spoken to anybody, that means that they've made a conscious decision not to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell by the tenseness in their voice, by the tone of their voice, whether they're trying to snow you or they're lying to you. So it's actually sometimes it's a benefit when the person has actually passed away and it's a family member that you're talking to. Oftentimes they feel less constrained than the decedent.
So even when you get a hold of a family member, you'll still kind of a deceased person, you'll still explain who you are and what you're doing and ask them if they have any stories?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it, like I said, sometimes it's a benefit because the family member is less constrained. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're just as constrained as the decedent, who's probably told them, don't ever talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
So we never know what we're going to get, is what I'm trying to tell you. And usually the ones that were thinking, oh, this person really knows what happened, they claim not to know anything. And oftentimes when you're just calling a name that you don't know, they will surprise you and know quite a bit.
Wow. And then have you ran across a family member who's been like that, where they're happy, they want to share what?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A woman named Carlene Green, she's in our book, both of our editions of Witness to Roswell. she told us of a deathbed confession of her father.
Mm-hmm.
And no one had interviewed her. We just found her just at random. And her father was a sergeant, again, out at the crash site picking up the debris. And he also saw the bodies. He described the bodies just as others had described them, as 3 to 4 feet tall, large head, frail body, no nose, no ears, just a little slit for a mouth and slightly slanted eyes. And he never told his daughter, Carlene Green, about it until he was literally on his deathbed. The ambulance was coming to pick him up to take him into the hospital for open heart surgery. He didn't know, and she didn't know if he was going to make it. And just as they're about to wheel him into the ambulance, he calls his daughter over, and he says, "I just want to tell you that Roswell." Now, here's a guy on his deathbed, and he wants to tell his daughter about Roswell,
mm-hmm.
about the fact that it was real, it really happened. He was out there, and he saw the bodies and the wreckage. And can you imagine that?
Yeah, wow.
And he told her, "Talk to your brother. He knows everything that I've told him." See, he had told his son, but he didn't tell he never told his daughter until mm-hmm. he was on the gurney being wheeled out to the ambulance. So, yeah, that was a case where she was happy to talk to us.
Wow, and so even though there's a lot of people who are reluctant to speak about it, you've still gathered quite a number of witnesses.
Yes, this is over the years. This includes everybody that that we've ever talked to that knew and told us something about the Roswell incident. We've made many more calls than the 600 plus witnesses that we have.
Right.
But of the, I'd say we probably made 2,500 calls, and we've got over 600 that have had information to share with us. Now, they're not all first hand witnesses. Many mm-hmm. of them are second hand witnesses, but they corroborate what the first hands have told us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, sometimes we'll get a witness. If you have enough witnesses that are saying pretty much the same thing, a template forms of mm-hmm. Of an image, and if you get someone whose story is so far out of that template, you more or less have to dismiss that as either bogus or something just doesn't fit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause if you get enough testimony that it's A and somebody is telling you Q, then you know that it's either not part of the same story or it's bogus.
Uh-huh.
So that's how we've been able to more or less put all of the pieces. It looks like a jigsaw puzzle. The more pieces that you fit in, the clearer the picture becomes. And that's where we're at now. I'd say mm-hmm. we have perhaps 90% of the story. What we're missing is what happened to the bodies after they left Fort Worth and Roswell and wound up at Wright Field or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. What happened to them, especially the one that was alive, that witnesses have told us about. That part of the story is still a little foggy.
Out of those 600 witnesses, about how many, what percentage of those would you say are firsthand?
That's a good question. Our mandate is to interview as many as we can. So right now we don't have the statistics, but I would say firsthand, I would say a third.
So that's still, what, like 200 people?
Yes.
That's somewhere, a lot.
Yes. I would say somewhere between a quarter and a third.
Uh-huh.
The rest are secondhand.
Yeah.
But these secondhand ones we're telling you about are the ones that corroborate what the
right.
firsthands have told us.
Right. Help fill in the picture. And the
yes.
reason I ask that is because Of course, we've seen the Annie Jacobson Area 51 book come out.
Yes.
Recently, Yahoo News did a really terrible Roswell story where their facts are not straight, and they never address the witnesses.
No. They see, in the case of Annie Jacobson, now, here we have over 600 witnesses, and we've named them. You know, it's not like, geez, I wonder who these people are. We've named them. She has a single witness that's anonymous. Now,
how
any court of law would dismiss that as hearsay, and it's only one. We've got hundreds. And, the weight of evidence is just overwhelming when you try to pit one explanation against the other. It's just not even a contest. There are other claimed explanations, but again, those are usually based on anonymous witnesses. And unfortunately for Annie Jacobson, she didn't know anything about Roswell before, and she doesn't know how to separate what would be fact from fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever this anonymous person told her, apparently she believed, and it isn't worth anything because the witness is anonymous.
It's unfortunate too that people like her don't do their research, and you all have made it very easy for them to do that. You've got your book, Witness to Roswell, people can refer to, get a fuller story about what's going on, and like you said, named witnesses that they can even contact themselves.
Well, what you do in those cases, if you're like Annie Jacobson, you don't want to know what's been learned so far. You just don't want to know because it contradicts what you're trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, journalists do it all the time. When they have a point of view that they want to advance, they don't consult what's gone before because they don't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what she's done. And I think what's interesting is her book was supposed to be about Area 51, but everybody focused on what she said about Roswell. And she got to a point where she didn't want to talk about the Roswell part of her book, because she was taking a lot of heat for it, and rightly so. But it's the same with the Nick Redfern story about snatchers in the desert, something like that. Well, he had anonymous sources as well. And you can't base a theory on that you want to put in a book on anonymous sources. It doesn't have any weight.
Then you can do that, but then it's mostly kind of a fiction type of piece.
Yeah.
I mean you can
make up anything. And,
yeah.
And that's why they're not secondhand testimony or hearsay is not allowable in courts of law, because you can make up anything. And I submit that they have.
Yeah. So do you feel there's a lot more work to be done on the Roswell case?
Well, we are just in a, of course, we're, I would say 95% of the people who were involved in Roswell firsthand are gone now.
Mm.
And there are very few left. That's becoming clearer and clearer to me. Very few left. But we will take secondhand sources because they, especially if they corroborate what everyone else has told us. What we are really focusing on now is trying to find a piece of physical evidence. That's the only thing we're missing. And whenever we debate a debunker, somebody like, what is that fellow's name? Bill Nye, is it Bill Nye?
Bill Nye, yeah.
The
science guy?
Mr. Science. He doesn't know anything about Roswell, hardly anything. the fallback position for them is, well, show me a piece of the ship. See, to them, that's evidence. Is if you have physical evidence, that's the evidence. But the thing is, in courts of law, testimony, if compelling enough, is evidence.
Mm-hmm.
Testimony has sent many a person to the gas chamber. And but to the debunkers, the only evidence that's acceptable is physical evidence. So we think we've won the case legally. We've been told many times by lawyers that it would be a slam dunk. But scientifically, we need a piece of physical evidence, and that's what we're focusing on. We call it the Holy Grail of Roswell.
Yeah.
Would be a piece of physical evidence.
Mm-hmm. Now, the only story I can recall of someone having a piece was, what was it, Mac Brazel's brother?
His son.
Mm-hmm.
Bill.
Bill.
We usually refer to him as Bill Jr. to differentiate him from his father, but it's just Bill Brazel.
Mm-hmm.
For 2 years, whenever he rode the ranch, and he was still finding little pieces of, he called them scraps, but they were pieces of the ship. Especially after a rain, they would wash up, and he would, whatever he found, he put in a cigar box, and it included some of the memory metals, and. So in 1949, this is 2 years after the crash, he was in Corona in the bar there, Wade's bar, talking about it, that he had a cigar box. He mentioned he had a cigar box full of that stuff. And the very next day, some airmen showed up at his house, his ranch house. And they said, well, we understand that you have a cigar box full of some items. And he said, yes. And Bill said he could tell by their demeanor that they were going to have that cigar box. So they asked him for the cigar box, and he gave it to them. And he said later on that he wished he hadn't given it to them. But back in 1949, you pretty much did what the military said. They had just won World War II, and they were at the height of their power and influence among the American people, and so he gave it to them. But he had some wreckage in there.
Yeah, and unfortunately it's gone. Now, over the years, you've probably had other people come and tell you they've got pieces and parts.
We've had some, mm-hmm. but they've all when it came to producing it, they all couldn't produce it.
Mm-hmm.
It was somebody else, or it was somewhere else. So those stories, you have to conclude, were bogus.
Yeah. So I guess your plan then is probably to do more archaeological kind of
work?
Yes.
Uh-huh. We are planning another archaeological dig on the Brazel Ranch, the J.B. Foster Ranch, which was run by Mac Brazel. This is where most of the debris came down in little pieces. The difference this time will be that we're going to dig in outlying areas, even away from the crash site, because the material from all descriptions was very light, and the wind kicks up out there, so the thought is that the wind had blown pieces of it away from the site, that the GIs or the airmen who were sent out to clean up the site would have missed. And so that's what we're going to do. We're going to concentrate on the outlying areas to the site. And granted, it's still a needle in the haystack situation.
Mm-hmm.
It will be totally fortuitous if we find anything, because it's a big desert out there and the wind blows in circles, and it can blow that stuff away for miles. So it definitely will be a just a matter of luck if we find something, but that that's the only proactive thing we can do as far as trying to find a piece of the wreckage, short of someone saying, well, we've had a piece in the family for 60 years and we're ready to let you have a look at it. So I had a fellow I talked to a couple of years ago. He says, oh, yeah, we had a piece of it. We used it as a doorstop for years. lived in Roswell. He said, yeah, we used it as a doorstop. I said, well, where is it? He says, well, I don't know. We moved a couple of times, and it got lost in the shuffle of moving. So that's what, you know, we get stuff like that.
That's funny. So people in Roswell should check their doorstops.
Then we have another woman whose husband ran the radio station in Roswell back in 47, and their son had gone out to the crash site, and it had taken some pieces before the military got there. And the story is that he kept it locked up in a bank deposit. What do they have in banks? Some sort of deposit box or something you can keep things in. He kept it for decades there, and then he brought it home and it put it in the attic. And I even volunteered to go through her attic to look for it. And she says, oh, no, I've already done that, and I can't find it. So there's another case. Another case is Jesse Marcel. We think there's a good chance that they put a piece of the wreckage underneath the patio. They had just poured a patio outside their back, outside the back door, and they had a piece of it, and they said, we better get rid of this. And so they went out. Marcel and Sheridan Cavett, the counterintelligence captain, they went out back with the piece and came back without it. So, well, we think that they put it underneath the patio. Unfortunately, the patio is now part of not an extension, but an add-on to the house. It's now a utility room, the base of a utility room inside the house. So to dig that up, you'd have to tear down the structure of the additional building, you know.
Oh, man.
So we've also had a story that there's a piece that someone put in the wall of the big hangar. Okay, well, that's a big hangar. What part of the wall, you know? So stuff like that so far we are unable to follow up on.
Do you have any feeling or any hope that there would be any way to get the government to come clean on Roswell?
No. They will never come clean on Roswell. And by extension, they will never come clean on UFOs because they don't want to answer any questions about Roswell. Most notably, the brutish behavior that they engaged in to silence civilian witnesses back in 1947. They were, today we would call them civil rights violations. They used threats of life and limb to silence civilians, which they cannot do. So they will never come clean on Roswell because of that.
Mm-hmm. So there's just no hope there.
No. And by extension, we believe that they won't ever come clean on UFOs because sooner or later, the question will get back to what happened at Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to answer those questions. No matter how silly their position today looks, that it was a balloon and these anthropomorphic dummies from the sky that were dropped from parachutes, just ridiculous.
Well, then even reading that, like in this recent Yahoo News, I think it was Yahoo News, and they wrote about how the Air Force has already come clean. They already told us it was a Mogul balloon, and then later these stories of bodies were these crash test dummies, and
well,
people were confusing their memory.
They're just following the Air Force line. That's all.
Yeah.
They don't want to know anything else. So, they're just accepting at face value what the Air Force said, that it was a Project Mogul. First, it was a weather balloon, and they admitted they lied about that. and then it became a Project Mogul balloon, which sounds good until you actually examine that position and it falls apart like a cheap suit. But they don't want to know the facts, so they just parrot the Air Force position. And, you know, how can you debate somebody like that? They don't want to know. They don't know the facts, and they just repeat the Air Force line.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, it's a very juvenile way of looking something. You know, it's like in grade school, you do a book report. You know, you don't know a whole lot, so you just basically parrot what was in the book. And in this case, they don't want to know the alternative explanations because it might upset the point of view that they're trying to put forth. So they just they accept the Air Force story that it was a Project Mogul balloon, and that the stories about little people were actually these anthropomorphic dummies that they dropped from the sky actually 10 years after Roswell. So just absolutely no connection.
And that's such a flimsy excuse or answer they have for that, which is that the witnesses' memories are fuzzy and
yes,
they're mistakenly saying it happened.
Something they call time compression. Now, I've never come across anybody that's suffered from time compression, meaning that as you age, your mind loses its ability to separate events in your life time-wise. And in this case, they're claiming that the people who reported seeing the little bodies back in 1947 were actually referring to these anthropomorphic dummies, which were 6 feet tall and were dropped from the sky by the Air Force in parachute tests in the 1950s. They're saying that they are unable they're conflating or confusing the time periods involved. Well, anybody that knows anything about aging, the aging process, is that what happens to as you age, and this doesn't happen to everybody, it only happens to some people, is that you might forget what you had for dinner last night, but your long-term memory remains intact.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fact, is that your long-term memory remains, but you lose track of more recent things. And that's only in certain, you know, a percentage of cases. But that's the Air Force position. Silly as it is.
Very silly. So you're going to be in Roswell this weekend.
Yes. They have a annual UFO festival. And Don Schmidt and I have been speakers there, and Stan Friedman as well, for, I'd say, well over 10 years, maybe 15 years, where we're speakers down there. And this year we're going to be talking about Roswell's reluctant witnesses, naming names. And another talk we're giving is about the alternative explanations for Roswell that have been put forth over the years, most recently the Annie Jacobson book. Her theory is that it was the Russians were trying to scare us.
Right.
So we'll be talking about that as well.
And use Nazi technology to do it.
Yes, and Joseph Mengele, the always popular Joseph Mengele, came up from Argentina, I guess, to tell them how to do it. It's so ridiculous on its face. It really doesn't deserve any discussion. But she got a lot of notoriety because she's allegedly a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's just a contributing editor to L.A. Magazine, or, you know, the Sunday supplement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what she is. But it's because she had the term journalist after her name. she got all this, she got more exposure for her book than we have for all of the things we've written over the years, over 20 years, yes.
Yeah. Well, I know in the past she's written other stories, been criticizing for overhyping things for just to get things to over-sensationalize things.
Yes, and I guarantee you she knew nothing about Roswell other than the name. And
yeah.
We there's a lot of people, well, I say a lot of people, there's some people that say, well, I'm going to go to Roswell over this weekend and I'm going to solve the case.
Mm-hmm,
well, you know,
yeah.
We've been on this case over 20 years, each
mm-hmm.
of us, and we're still learning things. But you take somebody like Annie Jacobson, I would guess that she didn't spend over an hour on this case.
Mm-hmm.
She talked to this anonymous witness and wrote everything he said down, and that was the sum total of her research.
Right.
And she gets to go on every show. I think she was on CNN, Fox, you name it. She was on it. And we were just stunned
mm-hmm.
about the coverage she got for this. And
well, I'm excited for this weekend, and there are still hotel rooms, I've read, so people can still go out to Roswell this weekend. Of course, it's the big festival where a lot going on, and you guys are speaking at the museum. We're actually going to have a table there too. So,
you are?
Yeah. Yep.
All right.
Yeah, our last magazine was on Roswell, and Don and Stanton contributed to it, so people can come and see those guys and learn a lot of information and see some of your talks. They sound really interesting.
Well, yes, we also have a panel every Saturday night, and I guess it's Saturday night this time. We always have a panel with Stan, Don, and myself, and this year I think we're including Kevin Randall, so it probably will be the four of us.
Great. The top four Roswell researchers.
You got it.
That's cool. So yeah, that's as good as it gets.
Yes. We hope.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Let's see. Your website is roswellinvestigator.com.
Yes.
And
the book is Witness to Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan, myself, and Don, we contributed to another book that just came out. It's called UFOs and Aliens. Is there anybody out there? It's by our publisher, New Page Books. And it's an anthology about UFOs and covers abductions and Roswell and every aspect of UFOs, and it just came out. UFOs and Aliens, is there anybody out there?
UFOs and Aliens. I didn't know about that. Great.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for updating us, and looking forward to this weekend, and thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I guess we'll see you down there.
Yep, we'll see you there.
All right.
See you hanging out.
Take care.
You too.
Hello, hello, hello. Is there anybody in there?
Hello. That wasn't really David Gilmour. That was me. David Gilmour, by the way, now that I'm thinking of him, is a supporter of Gary McKinnon, the UFO hacker. I wonder if he believes in UFOs. If any of you know him, ask him and let us know what you discover. Hey, maybe I'll see him in Roswell next weekend. Maybe I'll see you in Roswell next weekend. If you're going to be in Roswell, come by and say hi. I'll be in the table next to Don and Tom, or next to Stanton, or who knows. They're all my buddies out there. Lots of cool people go to Roswell and do some talks at the museum, and have tables there where they are signing books and sharing their information, and that's what the famous international ufologist Antonio Huneos and myself, Alejandro Rojas, with Hispanic names like that, so close to the border, hopefully we won't get in any trouble. And, you know, funny enough, our route really goes right on the border to Mexico out, and we kind of loop down and sneak up on Roswell coming from the south. So hopefully we won't run into any trouble taking that route, sneaking in this way. But, yeah, we're going to be there selling our Roswell magazines like I've talked about. So we won't be able to have our show next week, as I mentioned earlier. So we're taking the week off. And I don't have an old interview to kind of throw up there for you guys either, like I did for Memorial Weekend. So you're just going to have to, if you miss me, because I know I'm going to miss you guys a whole lot. But, of course, we have dozens and dozens and dozens of archived interviews. So if there's one, you know, go look there and see all those tons of interviews we have. And if there's one you missed, check it out, or if you want to listen again. Like Grant Cameron, I love the Grant Cameron one where we're talking about Spielberg and UFOs. Of course, that wasn't too long ago, but you can pick up my old Don Schmidt interview from over a year ago and hear some more about Roswell and his take on some of what Tom and I talked about, or a number of others. Or you can listen to Nick Pope in honor of the British and our independence from them. You can go listen to the UK guy Nick Pope, who's a British gentleman who, of course, worked for the Ministry of Defense, which is, I think, where James Bond works. So, really cool guy. He's always a lot of fun. Anyway, we will be back in 2 weeks with a phenomenal guest who I'm going to be very excited to talk to, because I'm very excited to talk to all of our guests. You guys have a wonderful 4th of July, and we will talk to you later. Adios, muchachos.